one-man revolution, a guerrilla scholar warrior, a renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
Okay, so today we're talking about American progressivism, and in particular, we're talking about the original batch of progressivism. So we're talking basically from about the 1890s to 1920 in American history. And I want to start off by reading you a bunch of quotations from American progressives of this time period so that you can start to get a sense of what they were all about. And the quotations I'm going to read you are from leading progressive intellectuals and politicians. So the first one comes from Richard T. Ely, who was an American economist and was actually a founder of the American Economic Association, the top, I think still to this day, I know it still exists, I believe it's still the top professional academic economic organization. So this is Richard T. Ely at the founding of the American Economic Association in 1886. We regard the state as an educational and ethical agency whose positive aid is an indispensable condition of human progress. While we recognize the necessity of individual initiative in industrial life, we hold that the doctrine of laissez-faire is unsafe in politics and unsound in morals, and that it suggests an inadequate explanation of the relations between the state and the citizens. End quote. And then again, you know, this is the guy founding the top professional academic association for economists in America, just wholeheartedly embracing statism, worship of the state. It's not just a necessary evil, as America's founding generation might have put it, and it is an educational and ethical agency, indispensable to human progress. I think this one quote right here already gives you a pretty good idea of a lot of the founding ideology of American progressivism. That the government is this wonderful moral thing that can do anything to improve the human condition. Next, a couple of quotes from Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson is particularly interesting in American history. I think he's a very strong contender for the worst president ever. And I might even do an entire episode just on that in the future. But for now, let's just say what makes him interesting and unique was that he was a leading progressive. He was a two-term president of the United States, under whose leadership a lot of important, mostly bad things happened. At least, you know, in my opinion, bad things happened. And he's also the only American president who was basically a career academic prior to getting into politics. He's the only American president so far who had a PhD degree, and his was in political science. He was a professor of political science and then president of Princeton University prior to briefly being governor of New Jersey and then becoming the Democratic nominee for president and getting elected in 1912. And what's really interesting about that is that we have this unique window into Woodrow Wilson's mind that we don't really have for most other presidents in American history. This was a guy who was writing papers and books and delivering lectures and so on for, you know, a couple decades or more before he ever even dipped his foot into real-world practical electoral politics. And so we have all of these writings and speeches of his. A lot of times with presidents, you're left, if you really study them, wondering what the hell they really thought or what they really believed, if anything. I mean, in some cases, I think it's pretty clear. You just have a power-hungry sociopath who's willing to say or espouse whatever it takes to get what he wants. But there's a lot of presidents in American history where, I mean, you can read 2-3 biographies on them, really good detailed biographies, and still be left wondering, you know, what the hell did this guy really believe at the end of the day? Well, with Wilson, like I said, we have this unique window into him. So here's a quote from Woodrow Wilson in a lecture in 1890. "Men are as clay in the hands of the consummate leader." Next, a longer one from a book he wrote called Constitutional Government in the United States, which was published, I believe, in 1908. Speaking of the president in particular, Woodrow Wilson was a big supporter of federal government power, and in particular of empowering the executive in the American system. Speaking of the president, he says, "For he is also the political leader of the nation. The whole nation has chosen him and is conscious that it has no other political spokesman. His is the only national voice in affairs. Let him once win the admiration and confidence of the country, and no other single force can withstand him. No combination of forces will easily overpower him. He is the representative of no constituency, but of the whole people. His office is anything he has the sagacity and force to make it." End quote. So here's another theme, aside from the state, the government, as being this wonderful instrument of human perfection, you have this notion that the executive in the American constitutional system, the president, is the most important thing and should be empowered. And provided there's a competent guy in the driver's seat, it is a powerful office. And of course, if you know anything about the American original founding tradition and conception, the idea was if any of the branches of the American government should have a little more punch, it should be the legislative branch because it more accurately represents the people. How impossible is it? I mean, you hear this all the time, that the president represents the entire nation. And this is one of those platitudes that, as long as you don't really think about it, might seem kind of plausible. But a minute or two critical thought and you realize how absurd this notion is. How on earth could one man, even let's assume he's the smartest, hardest working, genuinely honest, genuinely trying his best, how can one man accurately represent the desires and interests and so on of tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of unique individuals? How on earth? That's such an absurd notion. I mean, it's absurd to me. Today, I believe that each American member of the House of Representatives, based on how big the districts are, represents on average around, I think, 700,000 people, something along those lines. That to me is ridiculous. How the hell could you accurately represent the preferences and interests of 700,000 people? Could you do it even if you have an IQ of 180, a hell of a work ethic, and a ton of honesty, and a sincere desire to represent that many people? Could you do it? I don't think anybody could. I think even having, 435 to represent today 300 million people is a ridiculous notion. But they had this idea, people like Woodrow Wilson and other leading progressives, that the president should have the most power, that he should have a lot more pull than Congress on important matters, because the Congress is composed of people who only represent particular districts, or in the case of the Senate, particular states, whereas the president is elected by the whole nation. Anyway, getting to another Woodrow Wilson quote, this one from later in his career. This is in 1912 when he's running for president. Woodrow Wilson says, "All that progressives ask or desire is permission. In an era when development, evolution, is the scientific word, to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle, all they ask is recognition of the fact that a nation is a living thing and not a machine." End quote. Now, this is hinting at another deeply held progressive belief then and now, this notion of the Constitution as a quote-unquote living document. More on that later. Next, some quotes from Theodore Roosevelt, who also was a big-time progressive, was a two-term, or almost two terms, president in the progressive era, and who sought a third term later on a third party, progressive party ticket. Here he is in 1910. And by the way, before I get to Teddy Roosevelt's words, I just want to mention, it's true that Woodrow Wilson was a Democrat and Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican, but in reality, they were both big-time progressives, and while they might have differed a little bit on their rhetoric and on some of the details of their preferred policies. In terms of the big picture, there was really not a whole lot, if anything, to differentiate them. It's amazing if you go and read the speeches they gave against each other politically, a lot of the time they're saying the same thing in almost exactly the same words. But anyway, here's Teddy Roosevelt in 1910 talking about people's wealth and what's earned and what's not and the rights of the community versus the individual. And again, this is a mainstream American politician of the time. This is not a Socialist Party candidate or anything like that. And this is all the way back in 1910. Teddy Roosevelt said, "We grudge no man a fortune in civil life if it is honorably obtained and well used. It is not even enough that it should have been gained without doing damage to the community. This, I know, implies a policy of far more active governmental interference with social and economic conditions in this country than we have yet had. But I think we have got to face the fact that such an increase in governmental control is now necessary. No man should receive a dollar unless that dollar has been fairly earned. Every man holds his property subject to the general right of the community to regulate its use to whatever degree the public welfare may require it." End quote. Bet you didn't know how much of a radical statist Teddy Roosevelt was. Well, maybe you do if you read the same kind of books that I read. But here's this, you know, very socialistic sounding idea. It's not enough that you just earn your money honestly. You only have a right to what your community, quote-unquote, thinks you have a right to. And of course, by community and society, what progressives really mean is the state. They really mean the state. They like to use words like the community and society because these sound a lot nicer in a lot of instances than saying, yeah, the state is just going to take your property and give it to someone they think deserves it more than you. But you know, don't let the euphemisms fool you. They deliberately want you to conflate state with society when they're not the same thing at all. The state is a clearly identifiable coercive corporation with a monopoly on violence and taxation and so on. It is not society. Society is voluntary, nonviolent interactions amongst people in proximity to each other. And today, I guess we could maybe also talk about online interactions which don't require physical proximity, right? But, you know, a society is you, any private clubs you're a part of, any groups you're a member of, church you may go to, so on and so forth. People you do business with, your friends, people you socialize with, businesses you choose to patronize, etc. This is society. Society doesn't involve using violence to take stuff away from people. That's the state. Another quote from Teddy Roosevelt. This is from the 1912 election when he failed to get the Republican Party nomination and then went to the suddenly created out of thin air Progressive Party. And he called his speech accepting the Progressive Party's nomination for president a confession of faith, his words. And he gave this big long speech with, again, all these radical ideas that today we would consider really pretty socialistic in a lot of ways, and he closed out the speech with the line, "We stand at Armageddon, and we battle for the Lord." The crowd, the people at the convention, then began singing Christian hymns, such as Onward Christian Soldiers and Battle Hymn of the Republic, and they would substitute Roosevelt's name for wherever Jesus' name was in the hymns. So I think this is chilling in part because you get a sense of this cult atmosphere of follow the leader, this mindless following of the leader, treating him as a messiah figure, treating him as some sort of a deified, you know, he's above us. It also indicates something that we'll get a little more on in a moment, which is a lot of times people think that progressivism is necessarily secular or anti-religious. And that's because a lot of modern-day progressives are secular, are either non-religious or maybe even anti-religious. But in reality, the origins of progressivism as an ideology are highly religious. Highly religious. They really did have a sense that they were doing God's work to bring about some sort of earthly utopia. Some of them literally believed that by helping to bring about a better society, they were actually accelerating the return of Jesus in the form of the second coming. They honestly, earnestly believed this at the time. And I don't know if Teddy Roosevelt himself personally believed anything that went that far, but he clearly shared a lot of those people's attitudes, and he clearly understood that these were a lot of the voters he was appealing to. Next, a quote from a Baptist minister who was one of these pietist types who believed that Christianity required socialism, and also that by bringing about a more socially just system, people were helping to bring back Jesus. He was this sort of a Baptist, a guy what's known back then as a social gospel preacher. His name was Walter Rauschenbusch, and he wrote a book called Christianizing the Social Order, which was published in 1912. And here's a quote from that book. "Humanity must reconstruct its moral and religious synthesis whenever it passes from one era to another. If we want to conserve life, we shall have to re-socialize property. By socializing property, we mean, then, that it is made to serve the public good, either by the service its uses render to the public welfare, or by the income it brings to the public treasury. Society has rights, even in the most purely private property. The re-socializing of property is an essential part of the Christianizing of the social order," end quote. So a lot of these people were highly religious. They were what's called pietists. Many of them were social gospel or even Christian socialists. And they believed that when Jesus said to, you know, be kind to your neighbor and help those less fortunate, that he actually meant that not for you to voluntarily give some of your wealth and resources to your neighbor who's in need. But what Jesus really meant was empower the state to seize resources from person A and give them to person B, etc. Which is ridiculous if you read the things that Jesus actually said, and at least as he's depicted in the New Testament, is for the most part kind of skeptical of secular earthly political authority. I won't get into that today, but you know, read the works of Christian anarchists and you realize how blatant a lot of times it is that Jesus is criticizing the state. So anyway, won't get into that too deeply, but this is where a lot of progressives were coming from. This notion that when Jesus said to help your neighbor, what he actually meant is the state should be empowered to take and redistribute resources in order to create a more quote-unquote socially just society. Next, a quote from Frank Johnson Goodnow, who was president of the American Political Science Association. Like that American Economic Association, this is back then, and I think still to this day, the top or one of the top professional academic political science associations in this case. This is from a lecture that Goodnow gave in 1916, talking about people's rights. Quote, "The rights which man possesses are conferred upon him not by his creator, but rather by the society to which he belongs. What they are is to be determined by the legislative authority in view of the needs of that society. Social expediency, rather than natural right, is thus to determine the sphere of individual freedom of action. We no longer believe, as we once did, that a good social organization can be secured merely through stressing our rights. The emphasis is being laid more and more on social duties," end quote. So here from a leading progressive political science intellectual, we have a not even slightly subtle, total rejection of any notion of individual rights. Basically, if you have any rights, it's simply the result of they were deemed to be socially expedient by your legislative authority. And notice how slickly he starts off talking about society is what determines your rights, and then the next sentence he's saying, oh, it's the legislative authority. So you have a clear case of this conflation of society with state that I mentioned before. So you don't actually have any real rights unless your government authorities happen to decide that it might be expedient for you to have rights. I don't know about you, but to me, that's quite a chilling statement, and it's the kind of first step down the road that leads to all sorts of totalitarian hells, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not saying that the original American progressives were all necessarily totalitarians, but I'm saying that the arguments they put forth inevitably lead you down that path. Because what if you happen to be an individual or to belong to a group of people that your government authorities decide it's no longer socially expedient to accord rights to? Well, you can use your imagination and a little bit of historical knowledge, particularly of the 20th century, to come up with a pretty good guess as to where that might end you up. And this last quote is on education, and it comes from John Dewey, and something he wrote called My Pedagogic Creed in 1897. And listen to what he has to say about education. This is very important, because public education in the United States, and as far as I'm aware in much of the rest of the world, though I don't claim to be an expert on education in other parts of the world, as far as I know, in most parts of the world, public education is based on the same basic ideas that go back to American progressives, which, by the way, many of them took from Prussia, 19th century Prussia, Prussia with a P, which was the North German militaristic imperial state that eventually unified Germany under it. So anyway, here's John Dewey, My Pedagogic Creed. Quote, "I believe that all education proceeds by the participation of the individual in the social consciousness of the race. I believe that the only true education comes through the stimulation of the child's powers by the demands of the social situations in which he finds himself. Through these demands, he is stimulated to act as a member of a unity, to emerge from his original narrowness of action and feelings, and to conceive of himself from the standpoint of the welfare of the group to which he belongs. I believe that education is the fundamental method of social progress and reform. I believe that every teacher should realize the dignity of his calling, that he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of proper social order and the securing of the right social growth. I believe that in this way, the teacher always is the prophet of the true God and the usherer in of the true kingdom of God." End quote. Wow. That to me is a very revealing statement. It's amazing how much back then progressives were quite upfront with a lot of their beliefs in a way that many modern progressives often are not today. So education, according to John Dewey, he completely rejects the concept of education that existed for much of human history, which is that education is about individual self-improvement, individual self-cultivation. You become a less ignorant person, a more knowledgeable person. You come to better understand the world. You come to improve yourself, so on and so forth. You're improved morally, in addition to knowledge. Sort of the old Socratic idea of reason will lead you ultimately to happiness. Dewey rejects that, and instead it's some sort of collectivist sort of a project designed to, I mean, he doesn't say it, but geez, he might as well have said to make you conform to those in power around you. You know, to make you a good little drone is what it sounds like to me when he talks about maintenance of proper social order, which I'm sure is to be determined by progressive intellectuals like him, and when he talks about the right social growth. Kind of Orwellian sounding to me. And notice the quote closed off with him saying, "The teacher is the prophet of God and usher in of the kingdom of God." And this reveals to you, again, that there's a very religious undertone to a lot of these progressives. And Dewey was a guy who wasn't really religious as an adult, but he was, if I remember correctly, raised in a very religious household. And that's true of the progressives who were not conventionally religious. They were still almost always raised in a highly religious household. Very commonly, you'll find them being the child of a minister, some sort of pietist type of minister. And also, you find that even in progressives who don't directly espouse things like bringing in the kingdom of God on earth, that basically they still believe in that same notion of making a utopia. Only instead of speaking about a supernatural utopia, they're talking about creating an earthly material utopia through various types of government reforms. Now, before proceeding, I just want to mention some of my sources that I'm using here. One of them is a great book edited by an historian named R.J. Pestrito, P-E-S-T-R-I-T-T-O, and the book is called American Progressivism, A Reader. And this has a lot of primary source documents, speeches and essays and so on, from leading progressives so that you can read them extensively, their own words. Pestrito also has a book about Woodrow Wilson specifically. It's called Woodrow Wilson and the Roots of Modern American Liberalism, or something along those lines. It's also worth reading. It's just chock full of stuff on Wilson and his thinking. Another book worth checking out on this subject is Gabriel Kolko's book, and his last name is spelled K-O-L-K-O. The book is called The Triumph of Conservatism. Kolko's got some other good books relevant to this topic as well. Triumph of Conservative is probably his most famous. The book's like 50, 60 years old, but it's still highly relevant in terms of its myth-busting. Kolko completely takes apart the usual narrative of who the progressives were and what they were really up to, and more on that in a moment. And then one more book that I'll mention specifically, and there are others I could list, these are just a few of the main ones, is Liberal Fascism by Jonah Goldberg. And honestly, I'm normally not that much of a fan of Jonah Goldberg, but I'm willing to give whoever they're due when they write a good book or get something, hit something right on the head, so to speak, hit the nail right on the head. And his book Liberal Fascism is great because he points out the affinity, intellectually, ideologically, that a lot of American progressives have had for sort of fascists and vice versa. Something that's often obscured by the left-right terminology, which I consider highly flawed and highly misleading and in some cases deliberately designed to be such. This notion of left versus right, where you have communism way out there on the left, you've got fascism way out there on the right, and then, you know, just towards the center from that, you've got kind of socialism, liberalism, social democracy, and just to the center from fascism you have kind of conservatism and whatever. And this is highly misleading in a whole bunch of ways. I mean, first off, fascists were in many ways just a particular flavor of socialist. Mussolini, early on after he created fascism, kept repeatedly calling it a doctrine of the left. This is the guy who invented fascism. The German Nazi Party, don't forget the full title of the party was the National Socialist German Workers' Party. And they believed in all, aside from all their, you know, racial and militaristic stuff, they did believe in a social safety net and welfare programs and so on. So I like Goldberg's Liberal Fascism because it does a good job, I think, of showing the connections between American leftism and what you think of as kind of early 20th century, mid-20th century fascism in the European sense. I think it's a book worth checking out. So, the progressives, their beliefs, I think we could boil down some of the essentials based on those quotes I've read and things along those lines. They clearly were believers in collectivism rather than individualism. And again, these are quotes that I tried to make highly representative. I didn't go out and cherry-pick stuff that was weird or more extreme than the rest. These are, I think, quite representative quotes from leading progressive intellectuals and politicians of the time period. So they clearly favor collectivism over individualism. They're clearly not big fans of concepts like private property, the free market, private enterprise, etc., and they are willing to accept some degree of that, but only in a highly, highly limited and regulated sort of a context, which, you know, if you have free enterprise and private property, but the state can interfere with it or confiscate your stuff whenever they deem it convenient, you don't really have private property and free enterprise. Sorry to burst your bubble. Overall, I think it's clear the progressives are in favor of big government. By the way, many of them are also big-time warmongers. This is not 100%, but there's a strong correlation. Teddy Roosevelt's a wonderful example of this. So they're for state power across the board. They're for both sides of the welfare-warfare state coin. Teddy Roosevelt, the same guy who wanted to uplift the working man with regulations and programs and tamp down the influence of big business and so on. At least that's what he claimed. Teddy Roosevelt's the same guy who wanted to go around waving his big stick at everybody. And of course, the big stick meant the American military. Woodrow Wilson, the same guy who wanted all these progressive domestic reforms, is the same guy who got America into World War I. Clearly, they favor a large, powerful, centralized government. And of course, in the American context, they favor the executive above the other branches of the government. Their view of rights is that you don't really have inherent rights of any type. You just have whatever your society, as represented by your government, decides you should have. And when it comes to the Constitution, these are people who believe in that notion of a living Constitution. The notion that a written Constitution doesn't necessarily really mean what it says, or that you shouldn't actually stick to the letter of it. Instead, they believe that, well, you know, you can reinterpret it depending on the preferences of the people in charge at any given time. This is another one of those things that might seem superficially plausible when you don't think about it too deeply, when you just sort of say, well, you know, obviously back in the Founding Father days, they were riding around in horse and buggy and wearing those goofy wigs. So clearly, nothing that was said or thought or written down back then can have a huge amount of relevance to today when we have email and the internet and all this sort of stuff. But there's a lot of problems with this notion of a living constitution that has no fixed meaning. It doesn't even make logical sense, aside from the practical problems that I think you have. The Constitution, and this is true of any constitution anywhere, no, not just the American Constitution, but a constitution as such, what is it supposed to be? It's supposed to be like the fundamental law, the highest level of laws in a country. It is the set of laws that all the regular normal laws and so on have to not contradict in order to be valid. So how can you have a situation in which your highest set of rules does not have a fixed meaning and can be reinterpreted at will by the folks in charge? A constitution like that is no constitution at all. If you have a living constitution, you have essentially, for practical purposes, really not a constitution at all. And just in case you're having trouble grasping this, let me put it a different way. And this, I think I originally heard from the great economist Walter Williams talking about this subject. How would you like to play me in poker if the rules of the game are living? It would be absurd, wouldn't it? Or any other game, right? Play me in chess and the rules of the game are living. And oh, by the way, I'm the Supreme Court, so I get to reinterpret those rules. And maybe when it's my turn, my pawn can move like a queen. But maybe when it's your turn, your queen can only move like a pawn. You get, see how ridiculous this is, right? Now, I understand that there's always going to be some interpretation in practice of laws to real-life situations. I'm not denying that. My point is simply that to completely reject the notion out of hand that you should even try and follow, even make an effort to follow the letter of the Constitution, is a very dangerous and absurd notion as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, I have my problems with the American Constitution. I'm not one of these people who worships it and thinks of it as a perfect, divinely inspired document. I have problems with the American Constitution, both historically and in the present. That said, it is what it is. It's there now, so, you know, why not follow it? Like, why would you set up rules for a game and then say, well, these rules don't actually have any fixed meaning, they can be reevaluated whenever we want to? By the way, there is something in the Constitution. If you want to change how it's applied and how things work, it's called the amendment process. But of course, the progressives, for the most part, don't want to actually have to go through that. They want to be able to just, you know, rewrite the Constitution without rewriting it, so to speak, without going through years of trying to pass an amendment and so on. Now, there's another group of American history at roughly the same time, kind of around a little bit earlier than the progressives in a big way, and that's a group called the Populists. And if you're at all knowledgeable about this era in American history, you probably know about the Populists. They were largely thought of as kind of rural agrarian reformers who wanted to make things more fair for the American small farmer. And they had a lot of overlap with the progressives, but they still are distinct. And by the way, there's some overlap even in terms of personnel. A guy like William Jennings Bryan, who ran for president, I forget, three or four times. William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska would be considered a populist and a progressive, although he's a little more progressive. I'm sorry, a little more populist than progressive. But differences between a populist and a progressive in American history I think these are some of the main ones. First off, populists were rural and agrarian in their background and in the interests that they really were looking out for, whereas progressives were more urban industrial. They tended more likely to come from large northeastern and midwestern cities, whereas populists might come from the western farm areas, the western rural areas, and some of the southern areas. Populists claimed, and I think at least tried, to represent the common man. Progressives, they thought they were doing things that were in the interest of the common man, but the progressives were very elitist. Their attitude was, hey, wealthy, elite, Northeastern, Ivy League university educated guys like Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, they're going to do what's best for the common man. It might not actually be what the common man himself would want to do. But of course, the common man's too stupid to know what he really wants and what would really benefit him. Sort of reminds me, by the way, of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's notion of the general will. If you've ever read Rousseau's Social Contract, he talks about the general will, and he says, well, it's not the same thing as just taking a vote. It's not the same thing as an election, because a lot of times, if you let everybody vote, they're going to will things that are not actually the right thing or what's actually in their interests. And so you need leaders to decide what the general will is. Kind of another chilling sort of a concept. Populists were more from the West and South. Progressives were more from the Northeast and also kind of the Great Lakes, Midwestern areas where some of the big cities were developing in places like Wisconsin and Illinois. And in foreign affairs, populists tended to be more likely anyway to be anti-interventionists, to not want America going around the world trying to impose its will on far-flung corners of planet Earth, whereas progressives, almost to a man, and woman in some cases, were interventionists. The progressives who were around anyway at the time of the Spanish and Filipino wars that I've covered previously, they tended to favor those wars as a wonderful way for the American state, that educational and ethical agency, to increase the perfection of mankind even beyond the United States' own borders. There are, and there were, I'm sorry, back then, some leading anti-war progressives, but they were the minority amongst progressive leaders. Robert La Follette, for example, opposed American entry into World War I, as did, I believe, Jane Addams, the social worker who founded Hull House. But for the most part, progressives tended to be hawkish. And if you look back at the 20th century of American history, you find that progressives play a major role in America's entry into most of its wars of the 20th century. So the Filipino War was pushed for by Teddy Roosevelt during his presidency. I mean, he inherited it from McKinley, but he's the one that pushed it all the way forward to its conclusion. World War I, it was the progressive Woodrow Wilson who got us into that one. World War II, it was the progressive Franklin Roosevelt, who by that time, I think they were calling themselves liberals, but basically progressive, same thing, who got us into that. The Korean War was, of course, the progressive Harry Truman. The Vietnam War, the main guy responsible for that, at least in getting it to its big phase, was the progressive Lyndon Johnson, and so on. So, you know, this notion that all progressives are anti-war because I once saw a hippie demonstrating against a war who claimed to be a progressive is historically not accurate. Progressives have been some big-time warmongers in American history. So anyway, those are some of the big differences I see between progressives and populists. There's some overlap in terms of ideas. Both clearly believe in a bigger, stronger, more active government, doing things like intervening in the economy and so on. And there's some personnel overlaps, but they're not exactly the same thing. Now, there's a mythical narrative in American history that sort of goes like this. Back in the Gilded Age, late 19th century, kind of 1870s to sometime early to mid-1890s, there was this horrible phase of American history where big business was just totally taking over, and just the inherent forces of free market were reducing the amount of competition in the American economy and leading to more consolidation and the creation of monopolies or virtual monopolies in many industries. And then, thankfully, a bunch of progressive reformers and politicians came along and got the government to rein in those progressive interests and, rein in those big business interests and prevent the robber barons from just, you know, trampling on everybody else. Long story short, if you want the highly detailed explanation of why every facet of that myth is pretty much bullshit, read Gabriel Kolko. There are a bunch of his books that deal with things related to this. Again, a good place to start is The Triumph of Conservatism. In The Triumph of Conservatism, Gabriel Kolko, first off, he shows that during the late 19th century, the American economy, believe it or not, was becoming more rather than less competitive. More rather than less competitive. That attempts by many robber barons, quote-unquote, to create monopolies or cartels, when they were doing it purely on the free market, just like trying to buy out their competitors or trying to make deals with their competitors to hold up prices and so on, that these never worked for very long. They always fell apart through just natural market forces. And that the progressive movement was really not designed, the progressive, all their various legislation and so on, was really not designed to make the American economy more competitive. In fact, it was designed to help out the big guys at the expense of the small guys. And maybe I'll do a podcast or two down the road on some of this stuff in more detail. But basically, progressives, at least when it comes to the leading national figure politicians, progressives, for the most part, were not anti-big business. They were working for big business. And a lot of the reforms they were pushing were either openly or perhaps secretly being supported by big business. Because big business doesn't like competition. That's the reality. People oftentimes go, big business wants a free market so they can do whatever they want. No, in a free market, you can't do whatever you want. There's all sorts of discipline from competition and having to voluntarily woo consumers from potential competitors and so on. There's all kinds of discipline imposed by a true free market. But if you can get the government to set up a ton of regulations that in essence cartelize your industry and take away a lot of potential competition, then you have a situation where the big firms of today can try and freeze their spot at the top of that particular industry and not have to constantly play king of the mountain defending their position from young up-and-coming competitors. And if people are interested in more detail on that whole concept particularly, I'll be happy to get into it more in the future. Another thing I'll mention, and I sort of mentioned this in passing before, but progressivism cut across party lines. A lot of times people today want to think progressivism is and only has been a part of the Democratic Party, but the reality is that during the original progressive era, 1890s to about 1920, progressives were in both major political parties in the United States. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican, he was a staunch progressive. Woodrow Wilson was a Democrat, he was a staunch progressive. And I would argue to a large extent progressivism has been present in both parties ever since. Maybe not always dominant at any given time, but the progressive ideology has been there in both the Republican and Democratic parties ever since. Another thing I'll mention is that there was a lot of proponents of eugenics amongst leading progressives in the late 19th and early 20th century. Just to mention a few people who would have been prominent progressives of back then who had at least some degree of support for eugenics would include Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Margaret Sanger, who's often just described as kind of a birth control activist, and she was that, but she also, you know, crossed over into eugenics in some of her speeches and writings. Another progressive of back then who was a proponent of eugenics, a guy named Samuel Prescott Bush. Yes, of that Bush family, and I'm sure I'll get to them more in future podcasts. There's a lot of interesting stuff on the Bush family that you probably have never heard going way back. Now, eugenics, if you don't know what that is, my kind of layman's definition of it is, eugenics is the belief that a particular race or country or society, or maybe even you look at the whole human race, can only progress if the state gets actively involved in preventing certain people from being able to reproduce. And sometimes also on the flip side of trying to encourage desirable people to reproduce. So if you're thinking of, wow, this almost sounds like the Nazis, you're right. In fact, a lot of the Nazi eugenics programs were inspired by American eugenics programs. And this period of the early 20th century in American history was a heyday of eugenics, where there were all sorts of eugenics programs, including a lot of American states had programs to sterilize women who were deemed unfit or undesirable. And, I mean, this is real stuff. In fact, when the Nazis first started coming to power in Germany, some of the Nazi leaders were saying things like, man, we got to look to the United States as the leader in eugenics policies. And there were various other parts of Europe that were big into eugenics at the time as well. It's this weird, twisted, like Darwin mixed with statism. Because you could take Darwin and natural selection and so on in a couple of different ways if you want to apply it to politics. One way is you could say, well, this is why we need a laissez-faire approach and freedom in a free market so that the more desirable will just naturally prosper and thrive the most, and they'll, you know, outbreed ultimately the less desirable. And or you could take it and say, well, you know, we need to kind of help evolution along because, man, the undesirables are sure having a lot of kids. So the state needs to get actively involved in trying to prevent undesirable people from reproducing, up to and including forced sterilization in many cases. So, and by the way, I'm not a fan of either form of trying to apply Darwin to politics. I think that's kind of a weird misapplication of something where it doesn't belong. But, and I mean, I'm a fan of Darwin's theories when it comes to just pure biology. But I think it's very, very dangerous to start applying those to other areas beyond where they originally, you know, were intended to address, if that makes any sense. So, as you can imagine, when trying to identify undesirable groups, you find that the progressives were generally quite racist and xenophobic. Many of them were happy to identify African Americans as being undesirables who should be discouraged from breeding. They also would very frequently point to the various immigrants who were coming into the United States in large numbers in the late 19th and early 20th century. A lot of them didn't like the Irish. A lot of them didn't like Catholics in general. A lot of them didn't like Italians, didn't like the sort of Slavic peoples coming from Russia and Eastern Europe. A lot of them didn't like Jews. And they wanted programs that would try to prevent or discourage those sorts of people from reproducing. Many of them are cultures that would have larger numbers of kids, but a lot of the progressives, I shouldn't say a lot of them, most of the progressives, this generation, these early progressives, were WASPs, and they were WASP nationalists, so to speak. They thought that the Anglo-Saxon Protestants were superior. And of course, that's who they were, right? They were the WASP elite from the Northeast who went to Ivy League schools. Many of leading progressives, their ancestors had been in the United States since the 1600s. So they wanted to try to encourage people like themselves to breed more and discourage people whom they didn't like from breeding. And of course, they were willing to use, in some cases, even things like forced sterilization to get this done. So one thing I just want to mention a little bit more on is something I mentioned in passing towards the beginning of the episode, which is where a lot of these ideas came from. Well, there was some amount that came from a British group known as the Fabians. And you can look them up if you want. These were British socialists, but they were not Marxists. They were a particular type of socialist, the Fabians. And what differentiated the Fabians from Marxist and from most other types of socialists that were around at the time is that the Fabians, first off, were elitist. They believed in doing what they thought was right for the common man, but they did not believe in letting the common man actually have a significant say in running things. So that's a clear parallel you see with the American progressives. Another thing about the Fabians is they believed in evolution, not revolution. They believed in working with within the existing system to accomplish their goals of creating a socialist society where the state controls everything, or at least a lot of things. And that's another similarity to the progressives. The progressives didn't believe in any sort of dramatic revolution. They believed in just electing progressives to office and getting progressive interpretations of the existing constitution in place, and so on. So that's one place where American progressives got a lot of their ideas and attitudes, the British Fabians. Another place that I mentioned before is from Prussia, and after 1870, from Germany, once it was unified. You find that this is where a lot of the most statist ideas in American history come from, of all places, is from Germany. Horace Mann and other early education reformers in, like, the pre-Civil War era were inspired, and a lot of the beginnings of American public school came from these guys traveling to Prussia and observing the highly militarized society, kind of lockstep with a very strong state and universal public schooling, and they said, oh, this is what we need. This clearly is the thing to have in a free country like America, is to have this highly state-controlled system. Well, a lot of these progressives, even though they're a generation or two later than people like Horace Mann, they're more towards the end of the 19th century. Same deal. They traveled to Prussia after 1870, to Germany. Many of them were educated there. Many of the progressive intellectuals did some or all of their higher education in Germany. And part of it was because these German universities, which had a high degree of state influence going way back, a lot of these German universities were the first places in the world to have PhD programs, and especially to have them in the quote-unquote social sciences, like economics and political science, which is what a lot of progressives were drawn to, and what a lot of progressives got their degrees in. By the way, side note, I've always had a hard time with this whole notion of social science. I don't like the term. I think it's misleading. I think it leads you into trouble, because it implies that disciplines like history, economics, and political science, I don't even like the term political science, because it has science in it. It implies that you can have the same degree of certitude and accuracy and so on in these disciplines, and sociology is another one we could throw in there, that you have in, say, physics or astronomy. And the reality is, it's not even apples to oranges, it's apples to furniture. But anyway, maybe that's something I'll return to in a future episode. But the whole concept of social science, I think, tends to lead you towards these ideas of progressivism. And so in some cases, to even further to things like Marxism, which is another one of these social science sort of a things. And I think it's no coincidence that most academics are hardcore leftists, and the social science academics are probably more likely to be way out there leftists than others, or maybe leftists. Maybe I should say statist. I already said before my problems with terms left and right. So this episode, if you'll notice, I didn't really get into like the electoral politics or the laws and programs that were passed. That wasn't my intention. My intention here was to talk about the ideology of the time. That's why I named the episode Progressivism rather than Progressives or the Progressive Era. Now, I want to tell you what happens to the word progressive used to describe people who held these sorts of beliefs. In the 1920s, after a couple decades of progressive government culminating in American participation in World War I, there was a backlash against progressive ideas in the 1920s. And even though politicians and intellectuals, many of them still believed in progressive ideas, they couldn't use the label anymore, because the label progressive left a bad taste in their mouth, in the public's mouth. So, approximately around the 1930s, progressives began to call themselves liberals, a word they stole from other people who believed very different things. Up until about the 1930s, the word liberal generally meant somebody who believed in the ideas of people like Thomas Jefferson, Grover Cleveland. In Britain, the ideas of the Liberal Party in the 19th century, people like William Gladstone. And liberalism in this sense meant a minimal state, a free market economy, and individual rights and liberties. That was liberalism. In the 1930s, progressives start calling themselves liberals. And now the word, what used to, the word for the beliefs and the people who used to be called liberals, they're called either something like libertarian or classical liberals to make it clear that they're distinct from later liberals who believe in statism and essentially progressive ideas. So it was around the time of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s in the United States that progressives stole the word liberal for themselves. And it stuck, unfortunately, for those of us who like precision in what our words mean, even though many of the beliefs of these people were the opposite of what classical liberals actually believed. By about the 1980s, 1990s in American politics, the word liberal had, like progressive before it, become a bad epithet. You find, you know, just think of like Rush Limbaugh in his early heyday in the 1990s. To use the L word on a politician was to throw a big glob of mud at him. So what you find is that in the last decade or two, the word progressive has made a huge comeback as a label for people who share many of these same beliefs. Again, I'm not saying that every modern day progressive I don't believe is a eugenicist or anything like that. I'm not trying to say that at all. But clearly on a lot of the major issues, government programs, government intervention in the economy, modern progressives aren't a whole lot different from old-school progressives. So the notion that you're often given in very simplistic historical TV shows and books and things of progressives being just these high-minded reformers who just wanted to help out the oppressed and help out the poor and so on, I hope you're starting to get a sense that this is not even close to the whole story. Next time, I'm going to have an episode talking about some artifacts of progressivism. What I mean by that is things in America that we still have that are often considered just, you know, timeless pieces of Americana and the American heritage that come directly out of progressivism and the progressive era. So stay tuned for that episode coming out on Thursday. Thanks for listening. Remember to post comments. If you have any, feel free to email me, profcj@profcj.org. And thank you for listening to my Dangerous History Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.